This is episode 47 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Dan Lamoth and the role of being an embedded reporter.
Hey there, Fifth Estate listeners. Neil Doing here with a word from our friends at SimpliSafe. I heard an alarming news story out of California recently. A woman who was hired to clean homes was stealing from them at the same time. Imagine that. You pay someone to help take care of your home, and they burglarize you. How do you protect yourself from something like this? A regular security system won't protect you from the people you know and trust. No. Here's what you do. You get SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe makes it possible to know what's going on at home. If you want to check in, just live stream footage from the SimpliSafe camera directly to your smartphone anytime you want. You can get text message and email alerts when someone arms or disarms your system, so you'll be sure, you'll be confident that your home is safe. For 24/7 protection you can really trust, go to simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. Order a SimpliSafe home security system today, and you'll even get our special 10% discount. Go now, SimpliSafe.com/ricochet.
All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Oh, Jay, I'm in a mood.
You're always in a mood, Neil.
Yes, well, I know, but I am in a mood this evening.
Okay, all right, well.
But here's something that might make it better.
Yeah? What's that?
Well, if our faithful listeners would go onto iTunes and leave us a review and a star rating, that might help.
We love that.
It might just.
That'll perk Neil up. Make him happy.
It will.
Happy.
Well, let's not oversell this. I mean, I'm just saying it might be a different mood.
Well, at least for a few seconds, you'll be happy.
A few glimmering moments.
All right. So, hey, interesting thing. We had, I guess we had put out a question asking listeners, you know, some ideas for a show, like who would they want to have on or what kind of guest? And one of those was saying, hey, well, how about a reporter who's been embedded with the armed forces? And that sounded like a great idea.
Fantastic idea.
Yeah. And so I don't know our guest. He and I follow each other on Twitter, and I asked him, and he was kind enough, even on short notice, to do this. So Dan Lamoth of the Washington Post is with us tonight. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Sure, glad to.
All right, Dan. So kind of give us your background, kind of let the audience know who you are, what you've done, and then we'll kind of get into the entire process and what it's like to be an embed in with the armed forces.
Sure. Name's Dan. Grew up in Massachusetts. Came down to D.C. for grad school at Maryland and kind of found my way into military journalism from there. First job covering the military was with the Marine Corps Times. Independent paper, tends to try and cover it kind of for the enlisted guys and gals. So trying to look at it, things from that perspective, things that would interest them. I first embedded in 2010 in Afghanistan, kind of during the big surge there. Spent spring 2010 in Marja, kind of a tough fight, kind of a real eye-opening experience for me. Went back in spring of 12 and then again in fall of 12. All of those were kind of infantry embeds with the Marine Corps. And then joined Washington Post 3 years ago. And I've been back to Afghanistan once on the ground as an embed since then.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's the process to get embedded? I mean, I'm assuming not just anybody can do it, and or you know, there's some kind of criteria that you have to go through. I would think in order for that to happen, because it's dangerous, obviously. So what, like when you were going to do this, how does a reporter approach, you know, the military to say, hey, we want to send a, or how does your newspaper, your publication say we want to send a reporter over there? Just kind of explain how the whole process works. Give us like a 50,000 foot view.
Sure. So it's, I think it's evolved over time, and I can't speak much to the Iraq side of things because, you know, the MBEM program was essentially over there before I was trained to go anywhere. But on the Afghan side, you know, back in the heyday of the surge, if you kind of reached out, felt your way around, looked for a unit, that was one good way of going about it, and probably moved your name up in the stack a bit than just trying to apply, kind of going in the front door and, you know, with, you know, U.S. forces, Afghanistan and Kabul, and saying, hey, I'd like to go somewhere. I did get about a week of training prior to going anywhere dangerous. Program called Centurion, 1 week program run by some Royal Marines. You know, kind of the basics of patrolling, getting a sense for what an ID might look like. A lot of first aid. You know, how to deal with a fucking chest wound. All those sorts of things. And it was valuable to a degree, but I do think that, you know, 3 patrols on the ground in Afghanistan, and it was very much like, you know, you're absorbing so much more then just because it's so much more real. And I just spent a lot of time kind of paying attention to the squad leaders that were in charge and, you know, trying to get a sense for, you know, where they wanted me and what I should do and, you know, how much space to keep in between people and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I imagine that's just the kind of stuff that they can't really teach you in a couple weeks of boot camp or something. Just that experience from guys who have been on the ground.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think now that I've done several of them, you start realizing how things have changed, or how things change just based on, you know, what tactics the enemy is using. You know, how much dispersion they want to keep in between people. You know, I've been in places where, you know, if there was gunfire, you know, the idea was to get off the path as quick as possible. I've been in places where they absolutely didn't want you to do that because there were so many IEDs that it was a much smarter idea to just, you know, take a knee and trying to get low as possible, but, you know, not do anything too drastic.
Right. I mean, because the enemy responds to what we do too. It's not just us responding to them. They watch us, they learn from us. And so it's a constantly evolving situation.
Yes, and when you're getting thrown into the middle of it, where, you know, you're catching a unit where they've been on the ground somewhere 2 months, 3 months into the middle of a deployment, I've always found the best thing I can do is just get a sense for the way they're doing it. And if they're doing it a certain way, there's probably a good reason. So trying to pay attention to that.
So in kind of those changing environments, what are the rules that, you know, you have to follow as an embed, particularly like during, you know, engagements, firefights or what have you?
Well, the first one I get asked a lot is, are you armed? And the answer is no. And it's actually in the ground rules. You know, the idea is that you're there as a non-combatant. Obviously I don't think the Taliban necessarily feel that way, but at the same time, you know, I think there's a certain legality to it and a certain necessity to not being seen as yet another, you know, armed service member in the patrol. So that obviously complicates it. You know, you're not trying to necessarily be upfront. You're trying to get a good sense for what's going on. And there are times where you're not necessarily going to see everything with your own eyes. But a combination of what you're hearing over the radio, and then what you're seeing as well, you know, it gives you a pretty good sense. And then I think one of the real values of it is because you're going through those experiences when you get back after, you know, a mission or a patrol or a firefight or whatever happens, you know, people are usually much more willing to talk to you if you, A, have shown the interest and willingness to do it with them, and B, you're already kind of spun up on what happened today, and it's really just filling in blanks.
Mm-hmm. What about stuff like discipline, or like, you know, PT or something? Like, if the unit you're attached to messes up and gets assigned to latrine duty or something, do you have to stay around with them, or can you go where the story is?
Yeah, I mean, you typically can go where the story is. I mean, my experience has usually been, you know, especially during the surge when you had a lot of options, was to upfront say, okay, I want to spend 2-3 weeks with this battalion, and they may move you around within, you know, different platoons within the battalion, but you're usually going to have a certain degree of freedom to at least, you know, hop on the next mail train, or, you know, like, there are certain logical movements where you're just waiting for that next logical ride somewhere. So there is some downtime and some waiting, and a lot of hurry up and wait, like there is for everybody else. But if you have some good humor about it, you're usually gathering so much as you go that there's always plenty you can stay busy with.
Mm-hmm. And what about the consequences for breaking some of these rules? Like, for instance, if you, as an embed, were armed and you were found to be armed, what kind of consequences would there be? I imagine you'd be sent home, but anything further?
I think it probably is depending on the circumstances more than anything else. I mean, I can recall situations where, you know, colleagues, friends, other journalists have shared stories where they were running ammunition to positions, or, you know, were tossed a rifle because things had gotten so ugly. Those are, you know, extreme rare circumstances that I think speak to situations where you're just trying to get out. I've never been in anything that's nearly that dire. I mean, I've been, you know, in, I think some total probably 5 or 6 firefights and seen a handful of IDs and that sort of thing, but nothing where, you know, there were several hours straight where, you know, I was in the middle of an engagement. It was always more like 10 minutes straight kind of thing.
So what's that like personally for you? I mean, because you're not armed and you know, you're not one of the guys there. So what, you know, how what does that feel like to you? I mean, what, based on the training, what you do, but still, I mean, there must be a, you know, if not fear, then some kind of adrenaline that goes through when that's happening. So can you kind of explain how that feels? I mean, and how do you, as a reporter, keep your wits about yourself to be able to make sure that you can, when this is done and you go back, you can kind of write about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all the emotions you just mentioned absolutely hold true. You know, it is terrifying at times. It is very exciting. You know, the adrenaline does get pumping. I find that there are certain pieces of information that I'm just trying to keep track of. You know, when something does happen, usually one of the first things I'm going to look at is my watch. You know, I am going to try and get myself into the safest situation possible. You know, so there are times where I'm behind the next wall, or I'm, you know, in a canal, or I'm, you know, depending on what the circumstances are, you know, I'm always with someone that is armed. And oftentimes it's sort of pre-assigned ahead of time, you know, based on, you know, what the unit wants to do. But you're really just looking for the safe, you know, the most safe situation you can be in. It's still dangerous regardless, but you're not necessarily kicking in the door. You're more like the seventh guy going in the room kind of thing.
And what is the relationship? Obviously, you're a reporter, so your job really is to write these stories, write you know, these reports, but what kind of relationship do you have with the guys? I mean, is it friendly? Is it more just kind of a professional kind of thing? I mean, does it ever get to a point where you've stayed in contact with any of them? How does that work? I mean, do you try to keep your distance or to maintain a professional demeanor, or do you wind up becoming friendly with any of them?
There are people who I think are naturally going to stay standoffish. And I try and respect those distances. I mean, if there are certain elements of the story that they're the only one that can provide, I'm going to approach them as respectfully as possible at the best possible time. But generally speaking, there's usually at least a majority that is willing to talk and probably even to a degree excited to have you, especially when you start talking, you know, sort of that junior and enlisted level. I mean, they're usually, unless they've had a bad experience before or don't like your publication, I think those are usually the two hangups. You know, they're usually kind of interested in what you do. I do absolutely stay in touch with some of them. In particular, my first trip, you know, it was a really hard few weeks for everybody. You know, I kind of got there at the front end of the fighting season, and I think everybody thought Marja was a much safer place and better place in spring 2010, kind of after they took the town in February of that year. And then safety really fell apart as I was arriving. So I saw a whole lot more than I necessarily even anticipated. And, you know, the unit was going through a lot. The night I arrived, I remember landing in a helicopter and being there maybe an hour or two. And kind of as evening hit and it got dark, there were a bunch of Marines around a smoke pit, and a good majority of them were crying and like big, deep, heaving sobs. I mean, not like little tiny tears. And they had lost a guy that day, and it was a sniper that hit somebody in the face. And, you know, that was a real eye opener for, you know, basically my first day that was off the big FOB.
Wow.
There's a lot of funny moments and a lot of lighter stuff, you know, in between. I remember one situation from that first trip, and it's one platoon in particular where I stay in touch with, I would say, probably a dozen different guys to varying degrees. The convoy got blown up on the way, and everybody walked away, but the middle vehicle was a mess. It was kind of one of those all-terrain MRAP vehicles, the smaller ones, the MAT-V, they would call it. And we're kind of just sitting around waiting for a tow. So by the time we get there, it's a good several hours later. And my impressions at the time, I mean, I had been in Afghanistan maybe 2 weeks at that point with a different platoon, was, holy cow, man, I'm really out here. I mean, it was a, you know, not just in combat, but like this is kind of like as far toward the end of the road as I could get. You know, absolutely no officers, staff sergeant in charge. Nobody was shaving. Everybody was in shorts and flip-flops in between. And, you know, it looked much more like a movie than I think I thought was possible. But those guys, once I got there, you know, they had no cots. They had no nothing. Kind of offered me a spot on the floor to put my stuff down. And the first introduction was, hey, what do you think of Sarah Palin? And I remember thinking, just, this is like, you know, I'm a journalist, and really, regardless how I answer or don't answer or tap dance around this question, you know, it's kind of a loaded question. So I kind of gave some sort of politic, diplomatic answer. And I think they knew that it was kind of a fun way to put me on the spot. And I actually suspect I was probably not the first one that kind of got this particular spiel. So they said, all right, well, do you think she's hot? And I'm like, okay. If you had the chance, would you kiss her? All right, and they keep going, the various really questions kiss? Are getting more and more off color.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
I was going to say.
So, and then finally, it's like, okay, if you had the chance right now, would you want to meet her? sure, guys. Absolutely. I'd love to meet Sarah Palin this very second. And they said, hey, Gunny, come here.
Oh, boy.
We brought over the EOD tech, a bomb technician in the unit. And he turns around, and he drops trowel. And on his right butt cheek is a 4-inch tattoo of Sarah Palin.
That's great.
So, I mean, it was such a great icebreaker, and I think the fact that I, like, legitimately belly laughed, and, like, they were like, all right, this guy will be fine with us. And then the next logical question I had was, So I'm not here to get you guys in trouble. And this is not like a make or break thing, but if you're good with it, this is kind of an amusing story and I could absolutely write this up. And I kind of was willing to take that wherever they wanted to go. You know, it's not the story I'm there to get, but it's a cool story. And, the response was, hell yeah, maybe I'll get to meet her if you write it. So they were very easygoing and fun. And you know, this is a group that had virtually nothing. You know, the bunch of us were sleeping on cement floors in a schoolhouse that had no roof. I mean, it was, you know, and I think I got into my first 3 firefights with them over the next week.
Wow.
So, you know, like, and it was just a good group. And I do stay in touch. You know, that staff sergeant I mentioned is now a cop down in Asheville, North Carolina. A couple of the other guys are in Florida. They lost one of them to suicide. Mm. You know, it's a real mixed bag. So I've stayed in touch with some other parents because I was, you know, receiving emails from them. They're relaying messages through me, basically. You know, especially back then it was much harder for them to get online while they were downrange. So I kind of felt like a conduit a lot of time for families. And for me, that was one of the most special parts of the job.
Dan, do you think that after they come home, do you think that that's as big a story as what they do when they're over there? I mean, we hear about the rates of, you know, veteran suicide and that sort of thing. You know, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it really depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the happy ending for especially a lot of the young enlisted who, you know, come through and, you know, they get home and they're 21, 22, and they don't still know if they want to go to college and it might not be for them. You know, it's finding what's next in life. And I think when you're finding what's next in life while you're already saddled with, you know, whatever you had to see, whatever you had to do, and whoever you lost. I mean, that's a lot, and that's I think that's universal, and I think that will be in time memoriam, you know, 2250 when we're in some war in some country we don't even picture being, you know, in a conflict with. I don't think that changes whether we're shooting lasers or you know, stuck in the mud the way we were there.
Yeah. Well, what about your own experiences? You know, has stuff changed you? You know, what was your experience like? I mean, what did you take away from this? What did you learn?
It's something I need to check as an objective journalist, but I definitely became more protective and defensive of the young enlisted, I think.
Mm.
I think there's a natural inclination to want to give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, like when a general says something dumb in an interview, I'm almost definitely going to use it. I mean, for me, you're a grown up, you've been here, you've done that, you've served 30 something years, and odds are you knew exactly what you were saying when you said it. When a Lance Corporal says something, you kind of got to weigh whether or not it's really the story, or is it just like a layer that you got to kind of blend, and whether or not you quote them directly and whether or not you use their name. You know, I'm much more likely to kind of not put them on the hot seat unnecessarily. I think that's
perfectly, you know, perfectly sound, because I mean, we've all been 19 or 20 years old. And when you're that age, you say sometimes very stupid things. And if you're in the heat of the moment, sometimes you say incredibly stupid things that shouldn't necessarily be held against you. So I think that you're right on about that.
I think, you know, certain things, that first trip especially, you know, it was you got this platoon that's just been handed a platoon of Afghan soldiers, and it's kind of just as they're beginning to partner on a serious level where, you know, everybody's got somebody and they're building up the Afghan army so quickly that you're getting a lot of, you know, really weak recruits at best. You know, some of these guys, I think, were much worse, you know, than just bad at their job. I think there were other motives, but I think generally speaking, most of these guys were just thrown into a situation on the Afghan side that they didn't ask for, and they're trying to earn a living and whatever else, but they don't go home at the end of 7 months. And I think, you know, there's a certain level of exhaustion there, but they were dealing with a lot of, on the Marine Corps side, they were dealing with a lot of needing to keep these guys on task, needing to keep these guys disciplined. And when you got to worry about something like a negligent discharge from an Afghan soldier, because he didn't bother to unload his weapon before he cleaned it. You know, that's the sort of thing that, you know, like really opened my eyes. Like, hey, maybe I need to watch these guys as much as anything else we might be facing over the next ridge. And it's not even necessarily that they mean it. It's just that they're completely out of their depth. And they actually swapped out platoons of Afghan soldiers in the middle of my time with that particular unit. And there was no love lost when they left. It was basically get the hell out. So,
Well,
you know, that's just a different experience than you necessarily expect when you get on the plane.
I think we kind of take it for granted the professionalism of our armed forces. When you say, I mean, you look at these raw Afghan recruits versus our guys who, you know, we have the training and support to really build these guys into not just, you know, guys who are very good at killing and that sort of thing, but also, you know, who have the professionalism to use those skills.
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, instances where you've got a 22-year-old American corporal who, you know, is, you know, halfway through deployment and set up, but when he sees the Afghan next to him about to open fire on civilians that don't have it coming, you know, he grabbed that rifle and shoved it to the ground. And, you know, it wasn't him shooting. It wasn't his fellow American or, you know, service member who was about to light up the civilian. It was an Afghan on Afghan sort of situation, but he still, you know, had the presence of mind and, you know, the professionalism to say, hey, stop. And I think there are situations like that get taken for granted, because, you know, the assumption is that wouldn't happen, when the reality is that some of these times it didn't happen because somebody stood up and, even if they weren't in charge, they stopped something bad from happening.
And again, I think it's worthy of note that we're talking about, you know, for the most part, guys who are under the age of what, 25?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think one of the squad leaders I was with on that particular one was like 24 and on his second or third deployment. The majority of the rest of the unit were, you know, 18, 19, 20. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's interesting when, you know, you hear from them 2, 3, 5 years later, especially if you've gone a while in between. You know, one of them just got married last weekend. You know, and that's the sort of thing where, you know, it's like you're hoping for a happy ending. You know, you're hoping that, okay, you know, they've gone through a lot, they've dealt with whatever, and okay, he's 30 pounds heavier, not in the Marine Corps now, but he actually seems happy when you talk to him.
So Dan, let me ask you this. Like, would you, is this something that you would do again? If, you know, if you had the opportunity or if somebody asked you, would you go back and would you encourage other reporters to do this, or have you encouraged other reporters to say, you know, probably you should go over there to see if you can, to see what it's really like on the ground?
Yes and yes. I'm actually kind of poking around at different options, you know, for the rest of this calendar year. And I usually do, you know, I try to get somewhere interesting at least once a year. It doesn't necessarily have to be a war zone, and, you know, as options have dwindled, that's become tougher. But I certainly still look for those choices. And for me in my shoes at this point, I'll absolutely do it. I'm just looking for something that's, from a news perspective, worth it. So you get to the point where you're not doing all of those things that you used to. You know, if you're going to go and as you mentioned before, and you're there with the unit that's, you know, sorting mail, you know, good on them. And that's, you know, we need people doing that. But can I sell that trip to my editors and my bosses and say, here's why you should cut me loose for 10 days and spend, you know, whatever it is for combat insurance and everything else, 5, 6, 8, 10 grand. You know, it's a much harder sell. One of my frustrations right now is the lack of an embed program in Iraq. I think Americans have taken for granted it to a large degree over the last 15 years that there always typically is a journalist within stone's throw, not necessarily with everybody at all times, but, you know, probably going to get to an important story within a couple of days if they need to. And they're probably going to pick up all the slice of life stuff and all the atmospherics along the way. We're 3 years in to the Islamic State fight at this point. Right. And other than the occasional day trip, at least on the American side, they really don't do embeds in Iraq at all. You can embed with the Peshmerga. You can embed with some of the Iraqi units. And I've got colleagues who have done so and continue to do so. But the old sort of traditional, hey, I'm going to go spend time with, you know, a platoon here, or, you know, bounce around a different battalion for, you know, a couple weeks and kind of just pick up what I can and make sense of it along the way. Those days are over. There's no interest in supporting it. They would tell you that largely that's because they don't have the capacity to do so. And I think there's a certain fair criticism to that. But on the flip side, we've got 8,000 American troops, give or take, in Afghanistan, and we've got about 6,000 in Iraq. We're still taking embeds in one country, but not the other. So at some point, they start to lose me with their argument and their logic there.
Yeah, would you speculate that maybe there's a political component to that? Like maybe they don't really want us to know the level of our involvement in that theater?
I suspect there probably is a public affairs aspect to it, a political aspect to it. I think there's a diplomatic aspect to it. You know, the Afghan government very much wants to seem thankful. They want to encourage Americans to be paying attention to their country. You know, I hear it when I go to the Afghan embassy. I hear it whenever I talk to or interview Afghan officials, even now. I think the mixed nature and the fact that we're back again there in Iraq, you know, it's a much more sensitive subject.
Well, yeah, I've seen several reports from, you know, the, like you said, the embedded reporters with the Peshmerga, and those are actually quite harrowing accounts, because when they're embedded with these foreign fighters, again, you're not dealing with a professional army. And so these units that they're attached to, I think I read something, I don't remember where it was the Atlantic or Vice or one of the, it was a long read. But he was embedded with these guys, and they were just getting slaughtered because they were like a SWAT team that was fighting ISIS. And so, like, the casualties were astounding, which I imagine is much more dangerous for the reporter themselves. So,
yeah, I mean, for me, at some point it becomes the calculus of, okay, I absolutely want to continue to tell these stories, but when you start looking at risk versus outcome, you know, and what you're going to get out of a particular story,
mm-hmm.
you know, do I want to be that guy on the ground with that foreign unit, particularly telling the story for an American audience? Like, and I think those are personal decisions, and different journalists come to different, you know, outcomes with that. I mean, I've had friends who spent time with the Ukrainians and all sorts of other things. I mean, it's not even just Iraq.
Would you go to another theater, or like if things got really bad in North Korea or something?
I mean, I think if we hit a situation where, you know, and it doesn't seem like this is anything on the horizon, but yes, if we're all of a sudden talking about a, you know, Gulf War type environment, or we're going to roll in with another invasion, at least for the foreseeable future, yes, that's something I'd absolutely be not only interested in, but I think passionate about. I'm 35. I'm still able to do it. Still able to keep up. I think the calculus probably gets more interesting down the road if, there's kids in the picture and that sort of thing. And I think those are the sort of personal decisions you have to make along the way.
Well, Dan, let me ask you, before we wrap up here, what about, you're embedded with the Marines and with troops, but did you ever get to know any of the locals from the areas that you were covering? I mean, did you ever get to talk to any of the people there and interview them or talk to them about what they thought was going on, that kind of thing? Did you ever have those experiences?
I have to varying degrees. I've always found it different. When there's a language barrier there, it's a lot more difficult to know if A, what they're saying is really what they're saying. Does the interpreter have it quite right here? And B, those are usually sort of interviews you're doing along the way on a patrol. Are they saying what they think is the right thing to say, considering that there's standing next to the interpreter for the American unit and the American service member and the journalists? Is it theater or is it what they actually think? And sort of sorting through that is tricky. On the way in and out, I'm typically, either me and a photographer or me by myself. So, yes, you're going to absolutely meet the locals in and out of Kabul. You're probably going to go to restaurants and whatever else. And you're going to meet people along the way. It's much more Americanized, or at least, there's Western influences in Kabul, whereas you go down to Helmand, it's another world.
Fascinating, fascinating. Well, Dan, we're going to head into wrap here, but we just want to thank you so very much for coming on and talking to us about this and coming in blind, basically. We appreciate that. We could have been a couple of cranks, but in you came.
Yeah.
So we definitely appreciate that and offering this perspective. People just don't have these experiences. Not many people have them. And so it's, I think, very, very rewarding to, get an account of this.
Oh, thank you. I kind of look at it as you've got this, everybody talks about the civilian military divide, and I probably sit on that divide more than most. And if I can in any way bridge those two worlds a bit more often, I think that's why I'm in the game.
I think that's vital work. So thanks again. But before we let you go, Dan, we have one more question for you. And this is the only real gotcha question that we lay on people. And I want to warn you, it is a question of vital cultural importance. And it also happens to be something that Jay and I disagree on very strongly. So your answer matters. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Dan, is the show, the television show Seinfeld, overrated?
I don't even have to hesitate. I have always thought it is.
Yes. Yes. Dan, you answered correctly, my friend.
No, he didn't.
So quick little background.
Damn
Jay
millennials.
Is obsessed with this. With this show, Seinfeld, that was on 100 years ago, and it's about some new city, New York, right? But it's not that great. It's funny, but is it that funny?
Yes, it is.
It's really about nothing. It's a show
about nothing. How can I follow this show about nothing? I have nothing to follow. So.
Yeah. Well, Neil, you can watch Friends or whatever it is that you like to watch.
I don't like Friends either. I don't have those, and so I don't like watching shows about those.
Well, Dan, thanks again so much for coming on here again. Appreciate the short notice and everything, and the time that you gave us. I think like Neil was saying, I think it was very enlightening because we'll read your reports and we'll hear that people are over there embedded, but we don't get a sense of what goes on the day to day and what the interactions are like, and I think people are going to find that very interesting, and I think. The stories that you told are going to be fascinating as well, and of course funny. So that's always good.
My pleasure.
Well, we appreciate it, Ian. And if you know, if something happens and you're back out there, you know, stay safe, and we'll look forward to reading what you have to say. So, Dan LeMoth from the Washington Post has been embedded with the U.S. Marines in Afghanistan. We thank you for that. And that's going to do it for this week. Neil, do you have anything to say before we sign off?
No, Jay. I just no, I do not.
Well,
not
just
at all.
Again, just a reminder: if you like this podcast, you know, tell your friends, tell everybody else. Go out there, subscribe.
Right.
We need subscribers. We like subscribers because that way, you know, when we have a new show, it's going to be there for you. You don't have to search for it. You just update, and there it is. There's a new show. And leave us those ratings, please. Go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, leave a review. You know, when you have that chance, take a couple of minutes, and that helps us. It allows us to reach a wider audience, so we always appreciate that.
Yeah, that was what I was supposed to say for our audience who's still listening.
Yeah, since he didn't get my cue, but that's, you know, that's kind of...
I never do.
Never do. Anyway, all right. For Neil Dewing, I'm Jake Russo, and we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.